case number 2, McKeel Gibson versus Randolph County Sheriff.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Darrell Dunham. I'm representing the plaintiff appellate, Michael Gibson. I'd like to spend most of my time in oral argument on the excessive force handcuffing claim because I think that might be the one where the parties are the most divided. I noticed in the defendant's brief that they take the position that whenever the police have a probable cause to arrest, they have an absolute right to handcuff. That's the position they take at page 10 of their brief, and that's not what we believe the law to be. That might very well have been what officers Picou and Whaley thought, but we believe that when you look at the Graham versus O'Connor case, that the United States Supreme Court clearly established that even though there's probable cause to arrest, something, of course, that we dispute, but even if there is probable cause to arrest, there's not an absolute right to handcuff.
Now, what evidence is there in this case that excessive force was used in handcuffing Mr. Gibson?
The 2 points that we'd like to make, Your Honor. Number one is that shortly after he was cuffed, he complained that the cuffs were too tight. He complained about that several times. Now, there's a dispute in the evidence about that, but of course, in summary judgment, we have to assume what Mr. Gibson testifies is true. So the officer, Whaley, was on notice of the fact that the cuffs were too tight. And the cuffs were kept on even during his interrogation, well after he was taken to Randolph County.
But mustn't there be some evidence to substantiate the notion that the handcuffs were fastened so tightly as to constitute an unreasonable use of force?
Well, it's after the fact, of course, Your Honor, but an MRI revealed permanent damage to my client's wrist and arms. So, and he's complaining about it. He's complaining that he's under pain. And of course, we take the position that he shouldn't have been cuffed at all. Graham versus O'Connor says that just because you have a probable cause to arrest doesn't mean you have to automatically go and cuff.
Are you saying that that case says once a man is under arrest, he can't be cuffed?
No, I'm of course not saying that. The Supreme Court does, however, say that there are three factors that you should look at if you're an officer in deciding. One, the severity of the crime. This is not a severe crime. Number two, was there an immediate reason to believe that there's a threat to safety of the officer or others? Obviously not. Officer Whaley comes out to my client's house. He's not there. His parents and brother call him on the phone and says, come in, because they want to talk to you or arrest you. He comes in 20 minutes later and submits himself to the authority. This man is not any kind of risk to flee, or he's showing no evidence of that he's in an unsafe position with regard to others. And then finally, he made absolutely no attempt whatsoever, unlike the situation that we had earlier this morning, to evade or flee. Contrary, just exactly the opposite. I mean, this is maybe it's a little bit different down in southern Illinois. It's not uncommon when somebody's under arrest warrant that the sheriff will just call them up and they'll come in and submit themselves to the jurisdiction of the authorities. And I think that's what the case is here. And Graham and O'Connor also makes another important case point with regard to the officer said some of these situations are very intense, and we don't want to have Monday morning quarterbacking because we have an officer who has to make a split-second decision. That's not the case here. Officer Whaley had 20 minutes while my client drove over to his parents' house to submit himself to arrest to make a decision with regard to what he was going to do. And so what we are saying is that there are some cases where you don't automatically cuff the defendant, even though he's been arrested, and I think that the Graham and O'Connor case clearly establishes that, which then undermines their immunity claims.
Well, I don't think that anybody would have faulted the officer for not handcuffing if he chose not to here, but the fact that he did handcuff him, we see Enron people getting arrested. They always handcuff them and so they put them in the newspaper.
I haven't been asked.
Not going to run away or do anything like that.
I haven't been asked to represent any Enron representatives. Otherwise, you know, my fee would be much higher in that case. But, Your Honor, I think if you go back and look at Graham versus O'Connor, there isn't a per se rule, and there shouldn't be one.
But if you take a look at cases like Atwater, those cases say that custodial arrests, including the use of handcuffs, can be effective for even minor traffic offenses that involve individuals who are cooperating. The decision that's left in these cases to the particular officer.
Your Honor, I read Atwater, I think, very carefully, and it is true that in the ultimate result they said that with regard to the handcuffing problem, which was arguably an issue in the case, that they sustained. But that the issue of whether it should have been there should have been handcuffing in the first place was not addressed in Atwater.
Doesn't it stand to reason? Once you put someone under arrest, they're in custody. True?
Oh, of course, Your Honor.
All right. And then they're in the custody, they have a right to handcuff them, period.
Your Honor, if that is the position that you feel what the law is, then on the handcuffing issue, not on the, you know, the excessive force where he complained about the fact that they were too tight, we think that's a separate issue. I just don't think, Your Honor, that a careful reading of Graham can permit this court to say that in the Seventh Circuit there is a per se rule, that in whenever there is a right to arrest, there is a right to cuff, because it makes no sense that the Supreme Court in Graham would offer this kind of advice to the police officer. The severity of the crime, immediate safety of others, was there a risk of flight? And was there, in most of these situations, the officer is operating under a situation where he has to make a split-second decision. This man had 20, 30 minutes to make a decision about what he was going to do after my client showed up. I see my light is on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Bob Becker, and I represent the defendants in this matter, and since Daryl only talked about the excessive force, I'm going to restrict my comments to that issue also. I'm a late added starter to this case and a substitute as far as the oral argument is concerned, so my knowledge may be a little limited, and I certainly rely on Judge Gilbert's opinion and our brief. But I think if you look, I don't necessarily think that we disagree on what the law is as far as this excessive force issue is concerned. I think it's just a question of applying it to these set of facts, and I think Judge Gilbert does that adequately at page 14 of his order, where he says the court accepts as true at the time of Gibson's arrest that he offered no resistance, that he was handcuffed, that his wrists hurt, that he complained about being cuffed too tightly, and that Willie failed to remove the cuffs. The court accepts as true that the cuffs were on for 30 or 45 minutes during the drive to the county jail, and the court accepts as true that Gibson was treated for a sprained wrist 2 days after the arrest. In spite of all that, Dennis Gilbert finds that this was not an unreasonable restraint. And I think that Darrell is stuck with the record, of course, that he didn't prepare, that the attorney for the plaintiff did at the time. If you read Judge Gilbert's decision carefully, you will see that there's a lot of issues that were never tied together, such as, is this wrist a result of the handcuffing? And there's no evidence that it ever was. The court points out in its opinion, and we do in a brief, that Graham seems to make it a case-by-case basis as to what you should consider for excessive force, and that's what we think should be done here. At page 16 of his decision, Judge Gilbert goes on to indicate that there is no showing that Willie used an unusual amount of force in applying the handcuffs. There is no showing that Gibson had a pre-existing condition that made him unusually sensitive to being handcuffed. The minor nature of Gibson's injury indicates the cuffs were not used in a patently improper manner. Indeed, it is difficult to imagine how tight handcuffs could have caused a sprained wrist at all, and Gibson has offered no evidence showing that the handcuffing caused his brain rest. So I think that issue covers adequately excessive force. I think also, though, if we're going to discuss just right to handcuff, period, you have to remember that the record also indicates that Wheeling knew this particular plaintiff prior to the arrest. He had been previously incarcerated. He was going to have to take him in his patrol car some 30 or 45 minutes. I think it's, again, reasonable that the officer in this situation, even though the type of crime that was supposedly had occurred was not violent, that the officer should have been allowed to use the cuffs, and he did. Thank you very much.
Two minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Of course, we don't concede there was probable cause to arrest at all, and that's covered in our brief. The only evidence of it is that police report, and we don't even think it's admissible. We agree it's a case-by-case basis, which would imply that there at least are some cases where you shouldn't cuff an arrestee. And if this isn't the case, then I don't know what the case is.
You know, I know that you weren't the attorney at trial, but do you know if the trial attorney objected to the admissibility of the report below?
Your Honor, actually, he's the one that put it into the record. You're probably aware of that fact, but he put it in for the limited purpose, and we take the position that neither the defense or the district judge should have been able to expand it beyond the purpose for what it was admitted.
Yeah, but then you've got the Woods case, you know, an arrest report isn't hearsay if it's admitted to show the information on which an arresting officer made the arrest. So that's a problem here.
Well, Your Honor, my position is, even though it's got the label arrest report, it doesn't qualify. It's not even dated. It's not even signed. We don't even know for sure whether Whaley, that's even Whaley's handwriting, although I think it's more likely than not that it is. How can this even be, if it's a document that's been submitted, then it's probably in the file. It's not even dated. It's not even signed. And that's the only evidence of probable cause. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement. Proceed to case number 3.